I next met with Dr. Johanna Bendel, and to begin, she presented a case from her practice, who in fact was a primary care physician in the Nashville area.
So he was in a very good state of health, continuing to practice, 65-year-old gentleman, and he went to Wendy's, and he told me he never goes to Wendy's, went for dinner that night, ate a burger, and promptly threw it up after having trouble keeping it down. And he said this was just, he could feel the dysphagia, that there was something not right there. So he went to his local emergency room where they brought him in, and they did a CT scan, which showed a distal esophageal mass and multiple liver lesions. And so he gets this diagnosis. He knew, being a physician, exactly what it meant. And he decided that he wanted to get an opinion of an oncologist. But when I first called him and spoke with him, he said to me, "I don't want any treatment for this at all."
Wow.
Because he knew. And I said to him, "Well, you know, we can potentially palliate some of these symptoms you're having. You're having issues swallowing, you're having issues keeping things down. Let us at least give you some palliation and see where we go from there." And so he agreed to this, and he went for an upper endoscopy. And they found a mass in his distal esophagus, which actually stretched into his GE junction. They biopsied it and found it was a moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma. And interestingly enough, within the community practices, there's not a lot of HER2 testing that's done reflexively. A lot of practices are getting better at doing it, but I remember I actually had to order the HER2 testing on his tumor. And lo and behold, it came back as IHC3+. And so when we were talking together with this new diagnosis of metastatic gastroesophageal cancer with a significant amount of local symptoms, I said, let's try to get your local symptoms under control first, because I think there's a couple of ways you can handle it here. You could give them chemotherapy right off the bat, hoping that the response rate will help with the local symptoms. But oftentimes when the tumors start to recur, you're going to have to address that area eventually anyway. And so we decided to proceed forward with chemoradiation first.
Just out of curiosity, what kind of local modality would you have been thinking about if you were going to try to palliate him?
So we would be talking about chemoradiation combined. For him, he had a very good performance status. There are some patients where I might use radiation therapy alone if they were having local bleeding. I didn't need as much of a response rate, but we know that the local treatment won't be as durable if we don't use chemotherapy with it.
What about palliative surgery?
You know, you can also do palliative surgery, but I find in particular with the gastroesophageal cancers stretching down from the lower esophagus that surgery can be quite morbid in itself, the esophagectomies. Distal gastric cancers, where you can do a reroute, like a palliative gastrojejunostomy, that's a little bit easier. And there's some data that suggests that that's a good symptom control issue. But I think with chemotherapies that we have now, the radiation therapy, you may not have to send a patient to surgery.
What was it that kind of changed his mind about treatment? Was he particularly chemo adverse?
I think he was chemo adverse, and I think that he had resigned himself that he was going to die from this disease. And what eventually changed his mind is the fact that he was having local symptoms. And I said, let me just try to treat your local symptoms first.
So what actually did you treat him with?
So we gave him continuous infusion 5-FU with radiation therapy. We did it in a palliative manner where we gave him 3 weeks of radiation therapy with a continuous infusion 5-FU instead of doing more definitive where we would do 5.5 weeks of treatment.
What about trastuzumab in this situation with the chemo and the radiation?
So it's interesting. We are looking at trastuzumab and HER2 blockers in combination with radiation therapy, mostly in the setting of clinical trials right now. I think we also have to think about trastuzumab in combination with radiation therapy when you're radiating in the area of the heart and whether or not that might increase toxicity potentially. So I think right now, out of clinical trial, we have not been doing that, and we're saving the trastuzumab for later.
So what happened with this initial treatment?
So he was symptomatically better within about a week, and it was a wonderful way to earn his trust, because then he was eating again, and he was enjoying life again, and he was feeling very well. And so he was able to go to his wife's family's house in Arkansas for Thanksgiving dinner, and he started to get his life back again.
And what was the next step?
And so once he completed chemoradiation therapy, he actually looked quite good afterwards. I like to give people about 3 to 4 weeks off once they complete the chemoradiation therapy to recover. And so he took about 3 weeks off, and then we talked about treatment. And so we had options of giving him chemotherapy in combination with trastuzumab or clinical trial. And we ended up going for him with chemotherapy plus trastuzumab. And so there's been a lot of discussion lately about the optimal chemotherapy backbone for the treatment of patients with gastroesophageal cancers. I mean, traditionally, people have used cisplatin fluorouracil, ECF. There's data about DCF. There's data about capecitabine oxaliplatin. There's a lot of different regimens out there where I think if you look across the board, the response rates are very similar. And the times to progression are very similar. So the way I base my choice of treatment for them is more on toxicity profiles. And so for him, we chose FOLFOX chemotherapy as the backbone. And so he received trastuzumab plus FOLFOX chemotherapy.
And what happened there?
He had a wonderful response. He had a partial response to treatment, felt much better. And this partial response lasted about 6 to 8 months before he started to have disease progression within his liver.
And, you know, looking back, do you think that might have been a consideration? You know, of course, now you know he responded, although certainly that wouldn't be unusual, to maybe having given him FOLFOX trastuzumab before the chemo radiation, sort of bulk reducing him.
Yeah, and one can consider doing that. It's more of a judgment call between the symptomatology that the patient is having right then, because a lot of these chemotherapy regimens, especially in combination with targeted agents, have nice response rates that you could get a good local response from the start. And so one could have considered doing that. With this particular patient, with his aversion initially to chemotherapy, the metastatic disease in the liver wasn't to the point where I was very, very worried about that getting out of control. And I do think that chemo radiation therapy gives much more definitive local control. We proceeded forward with chemo rads.
So he then, as you said, had progressive disease. That was just on imaging. He was stable clinically?
He had started to have a little bit of right upper quadrant pain, maybe slightly more fatigue in hindsight, but he definitely noticed a twinge of that right upper quadrant pain coming through.
And certainly this kind of thing used to be very controversial in breast cancer and when somebody has a HER2-positive tumor and then has progressive disease. But nowadays, these patients with breast cancer get continued on anti-HER therapy and then a lot of times they'll have the chemo switched. I know there's a lot of controversy. I'm not sure what data we have on that issue in gastric cancer. What were you thinking at that point?
You know, I think a lot of us have tried to continue the trastuzumab along through multiple lines of therapy. It's getting more difficult, at least within our community oncology setting, of trying to get trastuzumab paid for with different types of chemotherapy. We have a very tight insurance company within Tennessee that, for instance, will only allow us to give trastuzumab in combination with fluorouracil and cisplatin. So we do have to make an adjustment in our chemotherapy regimens of choice. So getting the trastuzumab in combination with docetaxel, for instance, can sometimes be tricky.
Interesting. So what did you actually decide to do with this man?
So when he progressed, we decided to look into clinical trial options again. And we had a very interesting clinical trial at that point looking at lapatinib. And so this was looking at different formulations of lapatinib, a pill formulation versus a slurry formulation. And once the patients got through the first 2 weeks of treatment, they were allowed to continue on with lapatinib plus either chemotherapy or trastuzumab or various different regimens. And so we started him on lapatinib, and he told me that within a week of starting the lapatinib, his right upper quadrant pain disappeared. And so he continued on the lapatinib, and we added in trastuzumab to the lapatinib, and he actually remains on this right now, having a partial response of his disease. And he's been on this now for another 6 to 8 months and continues to have response.
That's an incredible story. What's his quality of life like, his mental state nowadays?
He has a young son who's 10 years old that goes to a local school in Nashville, and he regales me with tales of them going to school together. He's retired from his practice. He said he gave up his pager, which was a big step for him, and he just enjoys spending time with his son now. They read books together, and he's very, very happy.
Is he out there trying to look stuff up and bringing ideas to you? I kind of envision, you know, people finding out about things like TDM1 and pertuzumab and bringing that up.
It's interesting for him in particular. He has tried to walk the line of not doing that, though we all have patients that do that. T-DM1 is under investigation right now in the second line setting for HER2 positive gastric cancer patients, and I think we're all very excited to see data coming from that, and pertuzumab as well. Pertuzumab in combination with trastuzumab, as well as cooperative group studies looking at it in earlier lines of therapy. As you alluded to earlier, we're starting to bring the anti-HER2 therapies into the locally advanced setting.
And just kind of curious, have any responses been seen to T-DM1 or reported?
Right now, that trial is just opening, so I'm not sure where that's gone as of yet. Most of the T-DM1 experience we've had here at Sarah Cannon has been within the breast cancer realm, so we're waiting to see what happens with the gastroesophageal cancer patients.
Let's switch over a little bit to HER2-negative gastric cancer, which I guess is the majority, obviously. And finally, we saw something I thought was pretty exciting at the ASCO GI meeting about ramucirumab. So maybe you can talk about what that is and what was seen.
Yeah, so ramucirumab is a fully human monoclonal antibody against the VEGFR2 receptor. So whereas molecules like bevacizumab bind to the ligand, bind to VEGF-A, ramucirumab binds to the receptor itself and probably the strongest pro-angiogenic receptor, the strongest receptor for VEGF. And so there was a study that was presented at GI ASCO, which is the REGARD trial, where they randomized patients with second-line metastatic gastric cancer to ramucirumab versus placebo. And what they found is that there was an improvement in overall survival as well as progression-free survival for the patients who received ramucirumab. And what was very interesting about it is a few years ago, we saw data from the AVAGAST study, which was a study of capecitabine plus cisplatin plus or minus bevacizumab for first-line treatment of patients with gastric cancer. And it was a worldwide study, and the study overall was negative for improvement in overall survival. But when they broke it down into the subpopulations, particularly those patients who were treated in America, there was apparently a significant trend towards improvement in progression-free and overall survival for the patients who were treated with bevacizumab-based chemotherapy in the U.S. And a lot of people had talked about how the epidemiology of esophagogastric cancer is very different around the world. And in the U.S., we tend to have a much poorer prognosis type gastroesophageal cancer, and for some reason appears to be more susceptible to anti-angiogenic agents. And when you looked at the ramucirumab study and you looked at the breakdown of the patient population that was treated on that study, most of those patients were treated in North America, which is why we think that study might have been positive, whereas AVAGAST was not.
Any hypotheses about why in terms of North America?
It's hard to say. Is it a colon cancer type question where bevacizumab improves chemotherapy that does not do well in a particularly poor prognostic population? It's very difficult to say at the moment.
The thing that really struck me was that this is single agent anti-angiogenic therapy, which I don't remember seeing before. You don't even see that much in general of.
Yeah, and that was very different. We've seen targeted agents being tried before for patients with metastatic gastroesophageal cancer, including everolimus, which was looked at in the GRANITE study and presented last year at GI ASCO, where they looked at everolimus versus placebo for patients with second-line gastroesophageal cancer that was metastatic, which showed no improvement in overall survival. But what we're waiting for now is there's two other studies that are coming out. One is called RAINBOW, which is second-line paclitaxel plus or minus ramucirumab. And there was also a first-line randomized phase 2 study of FOLFOX plus or minus ramucirumab. So it'll be interesting to see if that holds true in combination with chemotherapy.
So, you know, I've heard people at the ASCO GI meeting saying, you know, because of the fact that there really aren't very many alternatives nowadays in gastric cancer, you know, I wish this were available, and maybe it should be, and maybe it will be. What do you think about it?
I think most definitely patients with metastatic gastroesophageal cancer need more treatment options. They're particularly very sick patients, and as we get more treatment options available to them, they're going to start to live longer and feel better. I mean, within second-line metastatic gastric cancer, most patients don't make it to therapy. And most patients who do make it to therapy have a very poor survival of about 4 months. So more agents means better survival.
And any other future directions for ramucirumab, either in gastric cancer or beyond?
So ramucirumab within the GI oncology world is also an investigation in colorectal cancer. And right now there's a second line randomized phase 3 study going on of FOLFIRI plus or minus ramucirumab for patients with colon cancer. And I also believe that ramucirumab is being looked at in hepatocellular cancers as well. So I think that they're looking at a very strong development platform for this drug.
Let's talk a little bit about colon cancer, and maybe we can begin by chatting about your 40-year-old man.
So this is a gentleman that was referred to me who's 40 years old, young man, who presented with some abdominal pain, was found in the end on a colonoscopy to have a transverse colon mass and was taken to the operating room for resection. And pathology showed a T3N2 moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma that he had resected. And on his staging scans, he'd showed no signs of metastatic disease, so he was a stage 3 colon cancer patient. And so he came to see me for evaluation about adjuvant therapy. And as we know, with adjuvant therapy in the stage 3 setting, standard of care is 6 months of FOLFOX chemotherapy. And so also at that first visit, we talked a little bit about the fact that he was 40 years old and that he was quite young. So of course, we went through his family history and talked about testing for HNPCC for him. Now, he agreed to proceed forward with the 6 months of FOLFOX therapy. And with his first cycle, he had a lot of nausea and vomiting. Didn't feel very well, but he was still getting used to the different medicines. And about a couple cycles in, he was getting to the point where he was having significant anticipatory nausea and vomiting, where he just was not tolerating treatment at all. He had sort of a pale gray look to him. He hated his chemotherapy and he wanted to stop. And so with the nausea and vomiting, we thought about how to potentially dose adjust to try to decrease that. So the first thing that I did is actually take out the boluses of the 5-FU and leucovorin from his FOLFOX treatment, giving him just infusional 5-FU and oxaliplatin alone. It didn't help significantly in terms of his nausea and vomiting, so then I had to address the other potential emetogenic agent that we were giving him, which was oxaliplatin. And so what we started to do is dose adjust the oxaliplatin, and we took it down initially by 80%, helped maybe just a little bit with the nausea and vomiting. And finally, what I did do is peel away the oxaliplatin, and this was about cycle 7 of his adjuvant therapy. And he continued on just continuous infusion 5-FU alone every 2 weeks. He felt tremendously better without the oxaliplatin added in. And in addition, what was very interesting, and I think folks in the community can agree with me that they see this, is though he had very minimal neuropathy that was not long-lasting, when he was on oxaliplatin therapy, once we stopped the oxaliplatin therapy, he actually noticed that he started to get numbness and tingling in his fingers and toes. And he was complaining about that more than anything else. Definitely no nausea and vomiting, but that neuropathy. And when I saw him yesterday in clinic, it was for cycle 12 of his infusional 5-FU treatment, and he was completing his adjuvant therapy. And he said he had never driven to clinic so fast before in anticipation this time of completing his adjuvant treatment.
I'm curious whether you thought about switching him to capecitabine and in what situations, say, if you're going to use a fluoropyrimidine alone, do you use capecitabine and how you use it?
Right. So for this gentleman in particular, I thought about switching him to capecitabine, but given his issues with nausea and vomiting in the past, though capecitabine is not typically significantly emetogenic, I didn't want to test that on him given that he was ready to walk away anyway. So then I continued him just on the continuous infusion 5-FU. He was already used to the schedule of the pump and just had a few more cycles to go. But there are definitely patients where I'll consider giving capecitabine, and I do give capecitabine therapy too, particularly ones who just don't want the pump for one reason or the other, and patients who want that freedom of being able to, if they travel away for their jobs and just need more time to be free of a chemotherapy infusion pump.
You know, when I saw this case, it made me think about, actually, we do studies that were basically surveys of oncologists, and we actually had a poster at the ASCO GI meeting, and we asked, I think it was 75 oncologists in practice and 25 investigators. First of all, we gave them a bunch of simple cases and asked the numbers that they would have in their own head in terms of risk of relapse with and without adjuvant treatment, with and without oxali, for example. And then we actually asked them for 4 cases each from their practices, the last 3 cases of stage 2 and the last stage 3, just to kind of see what's going on in practice. And one thing that we found, and I'm curious whether it applies to this man, is, first of all, the actual numbers, the numeracy of what we heard from these docs was very, very similar with the investigators and the docs in practice. They gave the exact same numbers. And you kind of got the feeling looking at this that there has been a numeracy that's entered into adjuvant treatment of colon cancer that maybe wasn't there 10 years ago, but kind of is like what happens in breast cancer. And I'm kind of curious, I don't know what kind of work this man did or what his attitude was, but did you actually discuss specific numbers in terms of what he might expect out of adjuvant chemo?
You know, it's interesting. You can do adjuvant online. A lot of people do that to give patients a much more accurate estimate of their risk of recurrence. What I try to do with my patients is talk with them in more general numbers. So when I see an average stage 3 patient and I see them, we know that stage 3 can definitely range in terms of rates of recurrence from, you know, 20 to 30% to 70, 80%. And with a T3N2 tumor, that's probably on the higher end of recurrence. But to keep the math easy, to give folks an idea of what kind of benefit they'll be getting from the treatment, I generally tell them, in general, for a stage 3 patient, you have about a 50% chance of recurrence. And giving you FOLFOX chemotherapy is probably going to decrease that risk by about 25%. And if I give you 5-FU-based therapy alone, it's probably going to decrease that risk by about 20%. And so that helps them understand a little bit about what that adjuvant therapy is buying them.
And what kind of sort of attitude did he have about it? I mean, I don't know, did he have kids? You know, was he trying to do everything he possibly could, that kind of approach?
He doesn't have children. He's a single man, and he took off work for all of his adjuvant therapy just because he felt so poorly. Though when I saw him at his last visit yesterday, he was very excited about getting to return to work and return to a normal life. For him, he was wanting to do everything he could to improve his chance of survival. And most definitely at his first visit, he was accompanied by about 4 different family members that were all pushing him to do the same, which I think influenced his decision. And I think also they helped him continue along and complete his therapy.
I'm curious what your thoughts are about the value of oxaliplatin. You know, as we've seen more follow-up of the older trials, maybe it looks like the benefit might not have been as great as we thought. What's your take on that nowadays?
Well, I think that oxaliplatin helps by a few percentage points, but I think the bulk of the benefit from adjuvant treatment really lies in the 5-FU. There's a lot of discussion about whether or not we need so much oxaliplatin to even see that benefit. When you look at the NSABP C07 study, there was a lot less oxaliplatin that was given than in the Mosaic study, for instance. And now we're looking at that within the intergroup. And I guess it's called the Alliance now, where it's an old CLGB study looking at 6 versus 3 months of FOLFOX adjuvant therapy. There's a secondary question about celecoxib after adjuvant therapy, but the biggest question is, do we need to be giving a full 6 months of adjuvant FOLFOX treatment?
One of the things we saw in this sort of case, kind of a collection we did, was a lot of oxali in stage 2 disease, even in older patients. What's your thought about that?
So there's been a discussion about whether or not oxaliplatin benefits patients who are over 70. There was data that was presented from the ACCENT database that looked at patients over 70 who were treated with oxaliplatin-based therapies, even in the stage 3 setting, and a suggestion that potentially oxaliplatin does not really help patients who are over 70. Now, there's been other analyses of other databases and other trials that suggest that potentially it does, and I think that there's a lot of back and forth about oxaliplatin-based therapy in an older population. My personal take on all of that is that you have to look at the patient that's sitting in front of you, because one 70-year-old does not necessarily look like another 70-year-old. And potentially the more robust ones you would be wanting to offer oxaliplatin-based therapy to, whereas maybe a more frail one you would feel better about not offering the oxaliplatin-based therapy. And in stage 2, we know that for the average risk stage 2 patient, oxaliplatin probably doesn't benefit them, and that the fluorouracil treatment, if you decide to use treatment at all, is of the benefit. And there's a lot of discussion about the high-risk stage 2 population and whether or not they might benefit from oxaliplatin added into their regimen, A lot of controversy there. The overall survival data from Mosaic suggests that with overall survival, oxaliplatin does not improve survival for high-risk stage 2 population patients, though it did in terms of disease-free survival. Were the numbers big enough? Concern, concern, concern. But I think oftentimes most practitioners will offer oxaliplatin-based therapy to their high-risk stage 2 patients.
You mentioned the NSABP C07 study. At the last ASCO meeting, there was data presented from that study from tissue samples looking at the Oncotype colon assay, and they purported to show a prognostic role of this assay, both stage 2 and stage 3, but in particular that they thought maybe they could dissect out patients who benefit and don't benefit by using this assay. Can you talk about what they looked at there and what you thought about it?
So what they've been using is the Oncotype DX assay in terms of looking at risk of recurrence, not only in stage 2, but in stage 3 populations. And I think all of us will agree that the recurrence score that's determined by this test does pick out who probably has a higher chance of recurrence, a higher chance for risk of recurrence. However, when they applied that recurrence score to should those patients receive treatment or do they benefit from treatment, they couldn't get a correlation there. So where I look at that assay is I think that it helps potentially predict who's going to have a higher risk of recurrence, but not who should be treated in the stage 2 setting. Now, within the C07 data, what they did is they looked at the recurrence score across stage 2 and stage 3 patients. And potentially, as you said, dissecting out who might need more aggressive therapy. Who are those patients at such a high risk of recurrence that oxaliplatin may have more benefit and improve their survival? And what they saw was an interesting trend towards the higher recurrence score, saying that you should use oxaliplatin in these patients, and potentially in the lower recurrence score patients, even with stage 3 disease, maybe oxaliplatin isn't giving as much benefit. I think that this study showed very interesting hypothesis generating data, but I think you still really need to look at that in a prospective setting.
In what situations right now, if any, are you actually ordering the Oncotype assay? Have you ordered it?
For me personally, because that assay is not telling me who I should and should not treat, it's not giving me definitive data, I actually do not order it personally. I don't think it helps change my decision tree in terms of who and who I would not offer stage 2 treatment to.
Any other tissue-based assays that are being looked at in the adjuvant colon cancer setting that you think might be promising in the future?
Well, there's the Coloprint assay, which has had some data published about it, as well as another assay that's been looked at mostly in Europe. When you look at those three different assays, the Oncotype DX assay probably was tested on the highest number of patients in terms of a validation set, which I think is very, very strong. The other ones still have some potential validity to them, but need to be looked at in larger trials.
So in terms of this man, what's your plan for him moving forward, particularly in terms of surveillance?
Right now, as he's completed his adjuvant therapy, there's a few things that I tell my patients. First of all, they're going to need a repeat colonoscopy 1 year after their diagnostic colonoscopy. Then, though it's generally recommended that patients have CT scans once a year with physical exams, labs, and CEA every 3 months, I personally scan them more often. I personally scan them once every 3 months because, in my opinion, for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer that present, I want to catch them early in a setting where I might potentially cure them if they have very localized metastatic disease. So my general treatment is to do CT scans, labs, and physical examination every 3 months for the first 2 years, then every 6 months for the next 2 years, then yearly. I also recommend to patients that they make sure they get adequate amounts of calcium and vitamin D in their diets, where we've seen vitamin D and calcium levels associated with risk of colon cancer if they're low. I also recommend that patients take a multivitamin, particularly a folate supplement, to also help potentially, as we've seen, risk of colon cancer associated with low folate levels. I tell patients to go on an exercise program. We've seen across most different solid tumor cancers that for patients who stay active, they tend to have a better survival. And then I also addressed the potential of whether or not it might be beneficial to go on a baby aspirin once a day. This is much more controversial as to whether or not that's a good recommendation to have and as to whether or not it'll decrease polyp formation, but particularly it could in the setting where you already have patients that were susceptible to developing colon cancer.
How about your 52-year-old lady? And again, just to remind you, she presents with abdominal pain. CT shows right colon mass peritoneal implants. Biopsy shows an adenocarcinoma, KRAS and BRAF wild type. Starts on FOLFOX Bev and asks if she can have any treatment breaks. Maybe you can kind of just present her.
Yes, yeah, so this was a patient of mine that came to me, 52-year-old woman, presented with the abdominal pain, had a scan which showed peritoneal implants as well as a right-sided colon mass. She did elect to go straight to chemotherapy, so there was a discussion when she was originally diagnosed about whether or not to take out her primary. And when we talked to her a little bit more about her abdominal pain, it didn't seem to be associated on the right side. It was more diffuse. She gave us a description that may have been more her peritoneal implants were causing her pain. So we elected to hold on surgery and go ahead and treat her with FOLFOX plus bevacizumab. She had an initial partial response to that treatment, did very well with it, but she has always been a nervous person. She's never wanted chemotherapy. She's never been quite tolerant of chemotherapy, even with grade 1-2 toxicities being her primary toxicity. And so we started initially by saying, okay, well, let's take off the oxaliplatin, give you 5-FU, leucovorin, and bevacizumab alone. She did not want to use capecitabine in this maintenance regimen. And she felt a little bit better without the oxaliplatin, but probably about 2 months later said, you know what? I don't even want any of the chemotherapy. Is there a way that I can take a break?
Now, what was going on with her symptomatology? And you said she had a partial response. What were you able to actually measure?
So she did have one primary dominant peritoneal lesion that was down in her pelvis that we've been able to look at shrinkage. She did have a resolution of her abdominal pain, but she was, again, one of those patients where even though her abdominal pain was better on the chemotherapy, just even the low-grade toxicities from chemotherapy felt like too much for her.
So what happened next?
So we had a long discussion about what to do at this point. She wanted to take a complete treatment holiday. And so I talked with her a bit about data that we have seen looking at complete treatment holidays for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. And that is mostly based on the OptimOx 2 study. So the OptimOx 1 study looked at FOLFOX-based chemotherapy versus FOLFOX where patients went on a maintenance with 5-FU and leucovorin. We saw that the time to progression and the overall survival were about the same. We saw that there was a significant decrease in toxicity in the patients who got the oxaliplatin held for their maintenance phase. And then we looked at OptimOx 2, where they did FOLFOX, then the 5-FU maintenance therapy versus FOLFOX versus complete treatment holiday. And what we saw in that study, which was stopped early secondary to the approval of bevacizumab, which was not present in either study, was that there was a trend towards decreased overall survival in the patients who had the intermittent chemotherapy arm, the complete treatment holiday. So right now, practitioners in general that I've seen, and me as well, have been sort of reticent to take off chemotherapy altogether or give a complete treatment holiday. And I talked with her about that, trying to convince her to continue on some aspect of her chemotherapy. Since she was only on 5-FU leucovorin and bevacizumab at the time, it would mean either taking off the 5-FU leucovorin and continuing the targeted agent alone or a complete treatment holiday. What I talked to her about was there is some data out there looking at targeted agents alone as maintenance therapy. The first data that came out was from the MACRO study, which looked at CAPOX bevacizumab versus CAPOX bevacizumab using bevacizumab alone as maintenance therapy. That study didn't seem to show a difference in overall survival with single-agent bevacizumab maintenance therapy, but the study was also underpowered to really definitively tell us that was the right thing to do. We saw data from the DREAM trial at this last year's ASCO looking at induction chemotherapy followed by either maintenance bevacizumab alone or bevacizumab plus erlotinib. The folks on the bevacizumab erlotinib arm did better, but they had more toxicity. But when you look at the progression-free survivals in both arms, they were about 9-10 months, which is about what we see traditionally with FOLFOX-BEV data. hard to extrapolate between trials. We're hoping to see some more definitive data on the targeted agent alone maintenance therapy from the AIO study. So there's a randomized phase 3 German study that just completed accrual actually in January that's looking at fluorouracil plus bevacizumab maintenance versus bevacizumab alone maintenance versus complete chemotherapy holiday. And then the Cairo 3 study, which is looking at fluorouracil bevacizumab maintenance versus complete chemotherapy holiday. So hopefully we'll get some more data there. But for right now, what I tried to convince her to do is at least stay on the bevacizumab, though I don't have a lot of good data to lay my feet on about.
Is she having any bevacizumab issues, hypertension, proteinuria?
No, nothing from the bevacizumab angle.
So, of course, I've got to ask you about the question of the day in colorectal cancer is what do you do with these patients when they have progression? Hopefully that won't happen with her for a long time. How are you approaching that? And maybe just comment on some of the data that you're thinking about. You have aflibercept now approved. Bev beyond progression is now approved. Regorafenib is out there. How do you put these all together?
So it's funny, for the second line treatment of patients, when you look back at the ARES and BRIGHT studies, which were the registry studies that looked at bevacizumab beyond progression, and the BRIGHT study, of course, was the first one that brought up that question of do patients who receive bevacizumab beyond progression do better? And when we saw the data from the TML study, definitively looking at bevacizumab beyond progression for patients, what we saw is the benefit from the TML study wasn't as good as we saw in the BRIGHT study and wasn't as good as we saw in the ARES study. So what made the difference there? And in my own personal opinion, what I think we saw is we as practitioners actually can pick out who's benefiting from anti-angiogenic therapy better than the clinical trials can. And what I mean by that is that we've all seen them, these patients that get their FOLFOX bevacizumab and they just do wonderfully. And those are the ones that generally you continue to give bevacizumab therapy to after first progression. So I think it really comes down to that individual patient. Did that patient do very well with bevacizumab-based chemotherapy, the first line of therapy? And if so, then I'm more inclined to continue bevacizumab plus FOLFIRI into the second line. Was this a patient who progressed rapidly? Was this a patient who progressed at first restaging? And we know from the TML study that those patients were excluded from the TML study. And would those patients be ones that I would be thinking more about something like aflibercept, trying to change up the anti-angiogenic agent? Or if they're KRAS wild type and they're having symptomatic disease, somebody who I might be trying to move an anti-EGFR therapy in combination with chemotherapy? Or do I just want to do chemotherapy alone? I think that regorafenib I've been saving to the last line, and it's nice to have another agent now for our patients with refractory colorectal cancer. But I think we have a long way to go to try to determine who might best benefit from the regorafenib therapy, and I think we're waiting for biomarker studies from that trial to come through.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it, which I haven't heard before, but it makes complete sense because I guess in the TML study looking at disease beyond progression, they didn't sort of have that gradation in terms of how well they did, so to speak. So that's a really interesting idea. What is your experience to date with aflibercept?
So I think aflibercept is a good agent. I think it showed improvement in progression-free and overall survival in combination with FOLFIRI. I think personally I've seen a little bit more asthenia, just like the trials have seen, using aflibercept with chemotherapy. Potentially a little bit more diarrhea that I hear complaints about from the patients. I still see neutropenia, maybe a little bit more, but I think the biggest thing is the asthenia that I've seen with the aflibercept.
What about regorafenib? You mentioned you're using it later line, which of course is where it was tested. What's your experience been? Have you seen any patients that you think benefited? What kinds of toxicities?
So I have one patient in particular who's been a patient of mine for the last 5 years, where he has gone through all of the different systemic chemotherapies. He's also been through about 3 different refractory phase 1 clinical trials. And I was running out of options for him when regorafenib came approved. And I started him on it, and I was thrilled because after 2 cycles, his CEA had dropped. And he has actually had a minor response to regorafenib therapy, is tolerating it incredibly well. I contrast this to other patients of mine where I've started them on regorafenib therapy and they come off after two or three cycles just not having any benefit from the treatment. I've seen toxicity similar to sorafenib, which is a brother of regorafenib, including fatigue. I've also seen hand-foot syndrome with cracking. What I do recommend for my patients who are starting on regorafenib is something similar to the sorafenib data we saw at ASCO last year for the hepatocellular population using a urea-based cream 3 times a day. So I've been recommending that to all of my patients that go on regorafenib.
That's interesting. You think it helps?
I actually think it does. I think that it causes them to be at least more conscious of making sure they have some maintenance to their hands. And using that lotion 3 times a day, I think it does help moisten the area significantly.
It's interesting because, you know, that was actually an oral at ASCO. And yet every time I've asked an HCC person about it, they don't seem to be that excited in terms of sorafenib. But it's interesting that you're using it with regorafenib. It's said that in most cases of toxicity, hand, foot, or whatever, that patients can be kept on it by dose adjustment, holding the drug for a while. Is that your own experience?
Yeah, and it's interesting when you look at the regorafenib dosing of the 160 milligrams a day, I've actually had to move into alternate day dosing, the way that the tablets come out, which I don't know if it's a smart thing to do with half-life of drug and the pharmacokinetics of it, but patients do seem to respond to drug holds, but most definitely the fatigue and hand-foot syndrome have been the primary toxicities I've seen with it.
Are there any situations right now where you would use regorafenib before an EGFR antibody?
I think living here in Nashville, we have a lot of patients that aren't so thrilled about getting diffuse acneiform rashes. In fact, I've been threatened that if I give my patients one of those, I'll be in trouble by my patients themselves.
I'm assuming you don't. Do you use cetuximab?
That's another loaded question. So within Nashville, we're in the allergy belt. So if I have my choice, I use panitumumab to avoid those infusion reactions. But we do use a lot of cetuximab on clinical trial here. I use probably 50-50 in my own practice. But for the patients who just don't want that rash, I will use regorafenib before an anti-EGFR.
I want to ask you about your 56-year-old computer specialist presenting with new-onset jaundice, mass in the head of the pancreas.
Right. So this patient presented with that mass in the head of the pancreas, new-onset jaundice, and in doing staging scans on him, we just saw a locally advanced pancreatic cancer. And so then the biggest question becomes, is locally advanced pancreatic cancer the same as it was in the era before FOLFIRINOX therapy? And here I'm talking completely free of any clinical trial data because we are looking at it in clinical trials in the locally advanced setting, but we don't quite know what to do yet. I think a lot of the excitement around the FOLFIRINOX data was not only its improvement in overall survival in the metastatic setting, but the fact that it had about a 35-40% response rate, which is something that we haven't seen in pancreatic cancer patients. And for those of us that have used FOLFIRINOX in the metastatic setting, we've seen that tumor shrinkage. So for this particular young patient who was very vibrant, who wanted to do everything he possibly could, we talked about what the standard would be, which would be chemoradiation therapy, followed by reevaluation. And I think we all know, for those of us that treat patients with locally advanced pancreatic cancer, with chemoradiation therapy, I think I've seen one in my career that I've actually converted to a resection candidate with chemoradiation therapy. And so when we talked about the new emerging FOLFIRINOX data and the response rates that were seen in the metastatic setting, he said, I want to try that. And so we actually treated him with FOLFIRINOX therapy, to which he had tumor shrinkage and was eventually able to be taken to the operating room where he had his tumor resected. And when they resected his tumor, they did find a few positive lymph nodes, but they saw within the tumor definite tumor necrosis and signs of chemotherapy effect. So then the next question became, so now that he's post-operative, he's looking okay, what do you do now? Do you use FOLFIRINOX out back? Do you use the traditional gemcitabine adjuvant therapy? What do you do? With this particular gentleman, I elected to go ahead and continue him on the FOLFIRINOX therapy for a total of 6 months just because he had had that benefit prior to his surgery. I think other questions that come up suggest you do radiation therapy in this particular patient. And I've had a lot of arguments with my radiation oncologists about this in terms of close tumor margins on resection. Would that make me more likely to use radiation therapy? Probably yes. Would you use chemoradiation therapy and then do more FOLFIRINOX? Potentially. But I think where we're operating here is in a very data-free zone where we're going to have to wait for clinical trials to really tell us what to do.
Is that, you know, a common enough issue that it's going to be studied in clinical trials?
Yes, and I think where you're going to see those trials come is the cooperative group trials. And I know that there's several academic centers looking at investigator-initiated trials to look at preoperative FOLFIRINOX and whether or not that might influence conversion rate.
So I guess the other question would be, if this same situation were to occur today, how would you approach it? And what did you think about the gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel data that was just presented?
Right. So I think that's the question of the hour. When you look at the IMPACT study, this was gemcitabine plus or minus nab-paclitaxel. You saw a response rate of about 23% for the investigator determined response rate is about 29%. It's a great regimen, showed an improvement in overall survival and time to progression for patients. And it was a much different patient population than the FOLFIRINOX study, than the ACCORD 11 study. With the FOLFIRINOX randomized phase 3 study, that study was conducted exclusively in France. And these were investigators that understood the FOLFIRINOX regimen, knew how to give the FOLFIRINOX regimen, had adequate supportive care for toxicities of the FOLFIRINOX regimen. And we all know that growth factor support is used here, strong antiemetics are used here, dose reductions are used here. And most of us in the United States, when we use FOLFIRINOX, give a modified FOLFIRINOX right off the bat. Now, contrast that to gemcitabine plus nab-paclitaxel, where the IMPACT study was worldwide and included several parts of Eastern Europe and other parts of the world where potentially there might not be as much supportive care available for the patients. So I think that you're looking at both good results and positive survival results in different populations of practitioners and patients and different availabilities of supportive care. And why I say that is I think that it would not be unreasonable to also look at something like gemcitabine plus nab-paclitaxel in the locally advanced setting or potentially to convert patients. Now, again, I've got no data here. Again, we're going to need the trials to look at this, which I believe are hopefully in planning. But I think that this emergence is yet another very potentially effective regimen for shrinking tumors.
So in the interim, we have to make clinical decisions, you know, in this case, based on indirect comparison, clinical experience, et cetera. But what are you thinking right now? I mean, for example, you know, typically, I think up until this presentation, people who saw younger patients like your patient would be thinking about FOLFIRINOX. Would you maybe be thinking about GEM-NAB instead?
You know, I think that I'm going to want to get more experience with GEM-NAB. We were part of the clinical trial, the IMPACT clinical trial, but I would like to give GEM-NAB to a few of my patients and see how the responses look and see how the toxicities look. I mean, so far when I've given GEM-NAB in the past, the primary toxicities have been blood count issues. So I have had to use growth factors on occasion, not automatically like I do with FOLFIRINOX therapy. Maybe a little bit of numbness and tingling or a little bit of neuropathy, but mostly hematologic based. And so I'd like to get more of a sense of how those responses look when I give GEM-NAB myself in clinical practice versus what I've seen already with modified FOLFIRINOX. And there's a big question of tolerability there. Can I give more GEM-NAB to patients than I can FOLFIRINOX and then potentially increase the efficacy that way? And I think a lot of it is going to be trying to get myself used to and some experience with these different regimens within my practice.
What about the older patient who you're not even thinking about FOLFIRINOX? What about GEM-NAB?
I think it's very reasonable to try. I think you just are going to have to watch their blood counts carefully. I've been using GEM-NAB in some patients now who are fairly heavily pretreated or have had a lower performance status. And, you know, consistent with the IMPACT data where they saw benefit in terms of survival for the lower performance status patients, I had one particular woman who I'm thinking of who I saw in my clinic yesterday. She had come in and she's actually a more refractory pancreatic cancer patient, but she's younger. And she was one that I saw who was sort of on the verge of not being able to be treated. She was starting to get a little bit sicker, more anorexia, more pain, not feeling as well. And I thought, if I'm going to do something, I'm going to have to do something fast. And I ended up giving her GemNab, and she did look symptomatically better within about 2 weeks of starting therapy. And so we've just been very careful to watch her blood counts and to watch her performance status and do dose adjustments if necessary.